Sorchak's face went white, his eyes bulging. "Have a care, Sorchak," the Hierarch said ominously. "If you protest my decision too strenuously, I might just decide that this whole incident was your fault. Kavat is sick with disappointment that she has no one to torture to death."
His look grew sly as he glanced at the priestess.
"Would you like to have Sorchak, my dear? I have always delighted in giving you these little gifts. I will even watch with some pleasure while you slowly pull out his entrails with red-hot hooks."
Kabat's flame-marked face was filled with chagrin. Yurian saw that she had been convinced that the Hierarch, as he apparently had so many times in the past, would meekly accede to her peremptory demands, and she had staked all of her prestige on the punishment of Tzadi, for whom she had developed an instantaneous dislike. Agachak's unexpected and almost contemptuous rejection of the accusations she and Sorchak had leveled struck at the very foundations of her puffed-up self-esteem, but more importantly, at her position of power here in the temple. Unless she could somehow salvage something, anything out of this, her many enemies would inevitably pull her down. Geryon fervently hoped that Tzadi realized that she was even more dangerous now than she had been when she had thought she held the upper hand. Her narrowed eyes grew cautious as she assessed the Hierarch's mood. Then she drew herself up and addressed King Urgot.
"There is also civil crime here, Your Majesty," she told him. "I had believed that the desecration of the sanctum was more serious. But since our revered Hierarch has discovered in his wisdom that those charges were unfounded, it is now my duty to advise you of a crime against the state."
Urgot exchanged a quick look with Agachak, then slouched lower in his chair, his eyes unhappy.
"The crown is always ready to listen to the words of the priesthood," he replied without much enthusiasm.
Kabat gave Tzadi another look of smug triumph and open hatred.
"Since the founding of our nation, the vile drugs and poisons of the snake people have been forbidden in Stolmurgos by royal decree. After this Ussa and his servants were confined in the dungeon, I had their belongings searched."
"Bring in that case," she ordered.
A side door opened, and an obsequious underpriest entered carrying Tzadi's red leather case. The phonetic Sorchak took it from him, his face also gleefully triumph.
"They heard the evidence that Ussa of Stithistor has violated our law, and that his life is forfeit."
He undid the latch, opened the case, and displayed Sadi's many files, and the earthenware bottle where Zith resided. Urgot's face grew even more unhappy. He looked uncertainly at Tzadi.
"Is there some explanation for this, Ussa?" he asked hopefully.
Tzadi's face took on an exaggerated expression of innocence.
"Surely, Your Majesty could not believe that I ever intended to try to distribute those items here in Tholmurgos," he protested.
"Well," Urgot said lamely, "you have got them with you."
"Of course, but they are for trade with the Malorians. There's quite a market for this sort of thing among those people."
"I wouldn't be surprised in the least," Urgot said, straightening in his chair. "Then you had no intention of peddling your drugs to my subjects?"
"Most certainly not, Your Majesty,"
Tzadi replied indignantly. Urgot's expression grew relieved.
"Well," he said to the glowering Kabat, "there you have it, then. Certainly none of us could object to the fact that our Nyasin friend here is bent on corrupting the Malorians. The more the better, I would say."
"What about this?"
Sorchak said, putting Tzadi's case on the floor and lifting out the earthenware bottle.
"What secret is hidden in here, Usa of Steethy Star?"
He shook the bottle.
"Be careful, man,"
Zadi exclaimed, leaping forward with his hands outstretched.
"Aha!"
Kavat exclaimed triumphantly.
"It appears that there is something in that bottle, that the slaver considers important. Let us examine the contents. It may yet be that some undiscovered crime lurks here. Open the bottle, Sorchak."
"I beg of you," Zadi pleaded. "If you value your life, do not tamper with that bottle."
"Open it, Sorchak,"
Kabat ordered relentlessly. The smirking Grolem took the bottle and shook it again, then began to work out the stopper.
"Please, noble priest,"
Zadi's voice was anguished now.
"We'll just have a look,"
Sorchak grinned.
"I'm sure that one look won't hurt anything."
He drew out the cork and raised the bottle to his eye to peer in. Zith, of course, took immediate action. With a strangled shriek, Sorchak arched backward, flinging both arms into the air. The earthenware bottle sailed upward, and Zadi caught it just before it struck the floor. The stricken priest clapped both hands over his eye. There was a look of horror on his face, and blood spurted out from between his fingers. He began to squeal like a pig, all of his limbs convulsing. He suddenly pitched forward, threshing wildly and clawing tatters of skin from his face. He began to bang his head on the floor. His convulsions grew more violent, and he began to froth at the mouth. With a shrill shriek, he suddenly leaped high into the air. When he came down, he was dead. There was a moment of stunned silence. Then Kavat suddenly shrieked,
"Sorchak!"
Her voice was filled with anguish and insupportable loss. She flew to the side of the dead man and fell across his body, sobbing uncontrollably. Urgot stared in open-mouthed revulsion at Sorchak's corpse.
"Torak's teeth," he swore in a strangled whisper. "What have you got in that bottle, Usa?"
"It is a pet, your majesty,"
Zadi replied nervously.
"I did try to warn him."
"Indeed you did, Usa," Agachak crooned. "We all heard you. Do you suppose I might see this pet of yours?"
A cruel smile crossed his face as he looked gloatingly at the hysterically sobbing Kabat.
"Certainly, holy one,"
Zadi answered quickly. He carefully laid the bottle on the floor.
"Just a precaution," he apologized. "She's a little excited, and I would not want her to make any mistakes."
He leaned over the bottle.
"It's all right now, dear,"
he said soothingly to the vengeful little reptile lurking inside.
"The bad man has gone away, and everything is fine now."
Zith sulked in her bottle, still greatly offended.
"Really, dear," Zadi assured her. "It's all right. Don't you trust me?"
There was a snippy little hiss from inside the bottle.
"Oh, that's a very naughty thing to say, Zith,"
Zadi gently reproved her.
"I did everything I could to keep him from disturbing you."
He looked apologetically at Agachak.
"I really don't know where she picks up such language, holy one,"
he declared. He turned his attention back to the bottle.
"Please, dear, don't be nasty."
Another spiteful little hiss came from the bottle.
"Now that's going entirely too far, Zith. You come out of there at once."
Cautiously, the little green snake poked her head out of the bottle, raised herself, and looked at the corpse on the floor. Sorchak's face was a ghastly blue color, and the foam was drying on his lips. Kabat, still weeping hysterically, clung to his stiffening body. Zith slithered the rest of the way out of her little house, dismissed the dead man with a contemptuous flick of her tail, and crawled to Tsadi, purring with a smug little sound of self-satisfaction. Tsadi reached down his hand to her, and she nuzzled affectionately at his fingers.
"Isn't she adorable?" he said fondly. "She's always so kittenish after she bites someone."
A slight movement caught Geryon's eye. Velvet was leaning forward, looking at the contentedly purring little reptile with an expression of wholly absorbed fascination.
"You've got her under control, haven't you, Uzza?" Urgot asked in a faintly apprehensive voice.
"Oh, yes, Your Majesty," Tsadi assured him. "She's perfectly content now. In a little bit, I'll give her a light snack and a nice little bath, and she'll sleep like a baby."
Urgot turned back to the hierarch.
"Well, Agachak," he said, "what is your decision?"
"Personally, I see no reason to continue this investigation. The slaver and his servants appear to be quite blameless."
The hierarch considered it, his eyes hooded.
"I believe you are right, Your Majesty."
He turned to one of his Grolems.
"Free this idiot boy," he said, pointing at Eriand.
Kavat, her scarred face ravaged by grief, slowly raised herself from Sorchak's body. She looked first at Urgot and then at Agachak.
"And what of this?"
she demanded in a voice vibrant with her emotion.
"What of this?"
she indicated the stiffening Sorchak at her feet.
"Who is to be punished for this? Upon whom shall I wreak my vengeance?"
"The man died through his own act, Kavat."
Agachak dismissed her demands.
"There was no crime involved."
"No crime?"
Her voice was choked.
"No crime?"
It was rising in crescendo.
"Are Grolem lives so cheap that you will now throw them away?"
She spun and fixed Tsadi with her burning eyes.
"You will pay for this, Uzza of Stithis Tor. I swear it upon the body of Sorchak, and upon that of Torak. You will never escape me. I will have my revenge upon you and all of your servants for the death of Sorchak."
"Why are you so upset, Kavat?"
Agachak asked with malicious amusement in his hollow voice.
"There are scores of Grolems in the temple. Sorchak was one, like all of the rest. Greedy, ambitious, deceitful. His death was the result of his own folly, and of yours."
A cruel smile touched his thin lips.
"Could it be that your interest in this dead Grolem was personal? You have long been my favorite, Kavat. I trusted you entirely. Is it possible that you have been unfaithful to me, seeking entertainment in the arms of another?"
Her face blanched, and she lifted one trembling hand to her lips as she realized that she had gone too far and revealed too much. Agachak laughed, a chilling sound.
"Did you actually believe that I was so engrossed in my search for the Tardian that I was not aware of your private amusements?"
He paused.
"Tell me, Kavat, did you and Sorchak ever succeed in raising a demon?"
She drew back, her eyes wide with sudden terror as she faced her master.
"I thought not. What a shame. All that effort wasted. Perhaps you need a new partner in your midnight rites, Kavat. Sorchak's heart was never really in your attempts anyway. He was nothing more than a cheap opportunist, so your loss is not as great as you might think. Do you know what he called you in private? He asked her, his eyes now alight. She shook her head numbly. I have it on the very best authority that he customarily referred to you as that scar-faced hag. Does that in any way mollify your grief?
Kabat recoiled from him, her face suffused with mortification, as she realized that she had just been cruelly humiliated in public. She whirled in a rage and kicked the dead man in his unfeeling side.
Scar-faced hag?
She shrieked, kicking the body again.
Scar-faced hag? Rot, Sorchak! Rot, and may the worms enjoy your stinking carcass!
Then she spun and fled, sobbing, out of the room.
She seems a trifle distraught,
Urgot observed mildly. Agachak shrugged.
The shattering of illusions is always painful.
Urgot pulled absently at his pointed nose.
Distraction, however, raises certain risks here, Agachak, he said thoughtfully. The mission of this slaver is vital to both of us, and an hysterical woman, particularly one with the kind of power that Kabat possesses, can be very dangerous. She obviously bears Usa here a certain enmity, and since he was involved in both her humiliation and the death of Sorchak, I would say that right now the temple might not be the safest place in the world for him.
Akachak nodded gravely.
Your Majesty's point is well taken.
Urgot's face brightened, as if an idea had just occurred to him.
Agachak, what would you say to the notion of my keeping Usa and his servants at the Drojum until we can see him safely on his way? That would put him beyond Kabat's reach in the event that her distraction impels her into any kind of rashness.
He paused nervously.
It is entirely up to you, Holy Agachak. There is much. Though what you say, Urgot,
Agachak replied,
a small slip here could put you at the mercy of Kalzakath and me on my knees before either Urvan or Zandramas. Let us, by all means, avoid those disasters.
He turned to Tzadi.
You and your servants will accompany His Majesty to the Drojum Palace, Usa. I'll have your belongings sent along later. You will be safe there, and your ship will be ready in a few days.
He smiled ironically.
I hope you appreciate our tender concern for your well-being.
Tzadi bowed.
I am overwhelmed with gratitude, Holy One.
I will keep the Dagashi Kabach here in the temple, however. That way, each of us will have in his hands a vital element in the mission to Rakhaga. It should encourage us to cooperate.
Of course, Urgot agreed hastily.
I quite understand.
He rose to his feet.
The hour grows late. I will return to the Drojum now and leave you to your many religious duties, Dread Hierarch. Give my regards to the Lady Tamazin, your noble mother,
Agachak responded.
I will, Agachak. I know that she will be smothered with joy to know that you remembered her. Come along then, Usa.
He turned and started toward the door.
May the spirit of Torak go with you, Your Majesty,
Agachak called after him.
I certainly hope not,
Urgot muttered to Tzadi as they passed through the doorway.
Your Majesty's arrival came at a critical moment,
Tzadi said quietly, as the two of them led the way down the hall.
Things were getting a bit tense.
Don't flatter yourself,
If it weren't for the absolute necessity of getting Kabak to Rakhaga, I'd never have risked a confrontation with the Grolems. I am sure you're a nice enough fellow, but I have my own skin to consider.
When they were outside the nail-studded doors of the temple, the Murgo King straightened and drew in a deep breath of the cool night air.
I'm always glad to get out of that stinking place, he declared.
He motioned to one of his guards.
Go get the horses, he commanded.
Then he turned back to the shaven-headed Niacin.
All right, you sly fox, he said in an amused tone. Now perhaps you'd like to tell me what you were doing down here in Troll Murgos, and why you've assumed this pose. I almost fainted dead away when I discovered that the mysterious Usa of Stithistor was none other than my old friend Thadi, chief eunuch, in the palace of Queen Salmisra.
Chapter 13. They clattered through the deserted midnight streets of Rakhurga, with the king's torch-bearing guards drawn up closely around them.
It is all a sham, of course, Urgot was saying to Thadi. I bow and scrape to Agachak, mouth pious platitudes to make him happy, and keep my real opinions to myself. I need his support, so I have to stay on the good side of him. He knows that. So he takes every possible advantage of the situation.
The bond between judge and state here in Tol Murgos is well known, Thadi noted,
as they entered a broad square where flaring torches painted the sides of nearby buildings a smoky orange. Urgot made a rather indelicate sound.
Bond, he snorted. More like a chain, Thadi, and it's around my neck.
He looked up at the murky sky, his sharp features appearing ruddy in the torchlight.
Agachak and I agree on one thing, though. It's absolutely essential to get the Dagashi Kabak to Rakhaga before winter sets in. Shahab's had his people combing all of western Tol Murgos for months, looking for a slaver to slip Kabak through Malorian lines.
He suddenly grinned at Thadi.
As luck had it, the one he found just happened to be an old friend of mine. I don't know that we need to let Agachak know that we are acquainted, though. I like to keep a few secrets from him.
Thadi made a sour face.
It's not too hard to guess why you are sending an assassin to the city where Kalzakath's headquarters are located.
I would not advise lingering for any sightseeing after you get him there,
Urgot agreed.
But then, Rakhaga is not a very attractive town anyway.
Thadi nodded glumly.
That's more or less what I thought.
He considered it, running one long-fingered hand over his shaven scalp.
The death of Zakath won't really solve your problems, though, will it? I can't really see the Malorian generals packing up and going home just because their emperor has been killed.
Urgot sighed.
One thing at a time, Thadi. I can probably bribe the generals, or pay them tribute or something. The first step is to get rid of Zakath. You can't reason with that man.
He looked around at the bleak stone buildings, harshly illuminated by flickering torchlight.
I hate this place, he said suddenly. I absolutely hate it.
Rakhurga?
Tol Murgos, Thadi. I hate the whole stinking country. Why couldn't I have been born in Tol Nedra, or maybe Sindaria? Why did I have to get stuck in Tol Murgos?
But you are the king.
That wasn't by choice. One of our charming customs is that when a new king is crowned, all other possible contenders for the throne are put to death. For me it was either the throne or the grave. I had a number of brothers when I became king, but now I am an only child.
He shuddered.
Oh, this is a gloomy subject, don't you think? Why don't we talk about something else? Just what are you doing at Tol Murgos, Thadi? I thought you were Salmisra's right hand.
Thadi coughed.
Majesty and I had a, slight misunderstanding, so I thought it might be better for me to leave Nyssa for a while.
Why Thul Murgos? Why didn't you go to Tol Hanath instead? He's much more civilized, much more comfortable.
Urgot sighed again.
I would give anything to be able to live in Tol Hanath.
I have made some powerful enemies in Tonedra, your majesty,
Thadi replied.
I know my way around Thul Murgos. So I hired these Ceylon mercenaries to protect me and came here posing as a slaver.
And then Jahar picked you up,
Urgot guessed.
Poor old Sadi. No matter where you go, you always seem to get mixed up in politics, even when you don't want to.
It is a curse, Sadi told him mournfully. It has been following me for all of my life.
They rounded a corner and approached a vast, sprawling building surrounded by a high wall. Its domes and towers rose in barbaric, torchlit profusion. And, unlike the rest of Rakurga, it was garishly painted in half a dozen conflicting colors.
"Behold the Drojum Palace,"
King Urgot said extravagantly to Tadi.
"The hereditary home of the House of Urga."
"A most unusual structure, your majesty,"
Tadi murmured.
"Oh, that's the diplomatic way to put it."
Urgot looked critically at his palace.
"It's gaudy, ugly, and in terrible bad taste. It does, however, suit my personality almost perfectly."
He turned to one of his guards.
"Be a good fellow and ride on ahead," he instructed. "Tell the gatekeepers that the High King approaches, and that if I have to wait while they open the gate for me, I will have their ears cut off."
"At once, your majesty,"
Urgot grinned at Thadi.
"One of my few amusements," he explained. "The only people I'm allowed to bully are the servants and common soldiers, and all Murgos have a deep-seated need to bully somebody."
They rode on through the hastily opened gate and dismounted in a readily torch-lit courtyard. Urgot looked around at the garishly painted walls of his house.
"Ghastly, isn't it?"
he shuddered.
"Let's go inside."
There was a large door at the top of a flight of stone stairs, and Urgot led them inside and down a long, vaulted corridor. He stopped before a pair of polished double doors guarded by two scar-faced soldiers.
"Well?"
he said to them.
"Yes, your majesty,"
one replied.
"Do you suppose that I could prevail upon you to open the door?"
Urgot asked him.
"Or would you prefer an immediate transfer to the war zone?"
"At once, your majesty,"
the soldier replied quickly, yanking the door open.
"Excellently done, my dear fellow. Just try not to jerk it off its hinges next time."
The king strolled through the door and into the room beyond.
"My throne room," he said grandiosely. "The product of whole generations of diseased imaginations."
The room was larger than the Hall of the Riven King in Geryon's citadel. The ceiling was a maze of intersecting vaults, all covered with sheets of the beaten red gold from the mines of Thul Murgos. The walls and columns were ablaze with inset jewels, and the chairs lined up at the sides of the room were inlaid with more Angorak gold. At the far end of the room stood a bejeweled throne, backed by blood-red drapes. Seated in a simple chair beside that throne was a silver-haired lady, calmly embroidering.
"Hideous, isn't it?"
Urgot said.
"The Urgas have been pillaging the treasury at Rakoska for centuries to decorate the Drojum Palace. But would you believe that the roof still leaks?"
He sauntered to the far end of the room and stopped before the black-gowned lady, who was still busy at her needlework.
"Mother,"
he greeted her with a slightly mocking bow.
"You're up late, aren't you?"
"I don't need as much sleep as I did when I was younger, Urgot,"
she said, setting her sewing aside.
"Besides," she added, "we usually talk over the day's events before you retire for the night."
"It's the high point of my day, mother,"
he replied, with a faint smile tugging at his lips. She returned his smile with good-humored affection. She was, Geryon saw, as that smile lighted her face, a remarkably attractive woman. Despite the silvery hair and the few lines at the corners of her eyes, Her face still bore the signs of what had once been an extraordinary beauty. A faint movement caught his eye, and he saw silk shrinking behind Toth's broad back and drawing up the hood of his green robe to conceal his face.
"Who are your friends, Ugut?"
the silver-haired lady asked her son.
"Ah, forgive me, mother. My manners must be slipping. Allow me to present Zadi, chief eunuch to Queen Salmisra of the Land of the Snake People."
"Formerly chief eunuch, I'm afraid," Zadi corrected. He bowed deeply. "I am honored to meet the Queen Mother of the Kingdom of the Mergos."
"Oh,"
Ugut said, mounting the dais and sprawling on the throne with one leg cocked up over one of the jeweled arms.
"I keep forgetting the amenities. Zadi, this is my royal mother, the Lady Tamazin, jewel of the House of Haga, and grieving widow of my royal father, Tar Urgos the Deranged. May blessings rain down on the hand that sent him to the bosom of Torak."
"Can't you ever be serious about anything, Ugut?"
his mother chided him.
"But you do grieve, don't you, mother? I know that in your heart you must miss all those wonderful moments you spent with father, watching him gnawing on the furniture, listening to his insane gibbering, and enjoying all those playful blows to the stomach and kicks to the head, with which he demonstrated his affection for his wives."
"That will do, Ugut," she said firmly.
"Oh, yes, mother."
"Welcome to the Drojum, Zadi,"
Lady Tamazin greeted the eunuch formally. She looked inquiringly at the others.
"My servants, Lady Tamazin," Zadi said quickly. "Elorns, for the most part."
"A most unusual turn of circumstances," she murmured. "The age-old war between Murko and Elorn has denied me the opportunity to meet very many of that race."
She looked directly then at Aunt Paul.
"Surely this lady is no servant," she said skeptically.
"A temporary arrangement, my Lady Tamazin,"
Polgara replied, with a profoundly graceful curtsy.
"I needed some time in another place to avoid some unpleasantness at home."
The Queen Mother smiled.
"I do understand," she said. "Men play at politics, and women must pay the price for their folly."
She turned back toward her son.
"And how did your interview with the Hierarch go?"
"Not bad," he shrugged. "I groveled enough to keep him happy."
"That is enough, Ugut."
Her voice was growing sharp.
"Agachak is in a position to do you a great service, so you must show him the proper respect."
Ugut flinched slightly at her tone.
"Yes, mother," he replied meekly. "Oh, I almost forgot. The priestess Kabat had a bit of a setback."
The Queen Mother's expression became one of disgust.
"Her behavior is a public scandal. I cannot understand why Agachak tolerates her."
"I think he finds her amusing, mother. Grolums have a peculiar sense of humor. Anyway, she had this friend, a very close friend, who had a bit of an accident. She'll need to find another playmate before she can scandalize the good people of Rak-Urga anymore."
"Why do you persist in being so frivolous, Ugut?"
"Why don't we just call it a symptom of my incipient madness?"
"You are not going to go mad," she said firmly.
"Of course I'm going to go mad, mother. I'm rather looking forward to it."
"You're impossible to talk with when you are like this. Are you going to stay up much longer?"
"I don't think so. Toddy and I have a few things to discuss, but they can wait until tomorrow."
The Queen Mother turned back toward Polgara.
"My quarters are most spacious, lady. Would you and your attendants care to share them with me during your stay here in the Drojum?"
"We would be very honored, my lady," Polgara said.
"Very well, then,"
Ugut's mother said.
"Prala,"
she called. The girl who stepped from the shadows behind the throne was slender, perhaps 16 years old. She wore a black gown and had long, lustrous black hair. The dark, angular eyes that made most Murgle men look so alien were in her case very large and delicately almond-shaped, giving her features an exotic beauty. Her expression, however, was filled with a resolve uncommon in one so young. She stepped to Lady Tamazin's chair and helped her to her feet. Urgot's face darkened, and his eyes grew flinty as he watched his mother limp down the dais, leaning heavily on the girl's shoulder.
"A little gift from the inestimable Tower Ugas," he said to Tsadi. "One evening when he was feeling playful, he knocked my mother down a flight of stairs and broke her hip. She's had that limp ever since."
"I don't even notice it anymore, Urgot."
"It is amazing how all of our minor aches and pains got better right after King Kolhag's saber slid through my father's guts."
Urgot paused.
"I wonder if it is too late to send Kolhag some small token of my appreciation."
"Oh,"
the Queen Mother said to Polgara,
"this is Lady Prala, a princess of the House of Catan."
"Princess?"
Polgara greeted the slender girl supporting Lady Tamazin.
"Milady,"
Prala responded with a clear voice. Lady Tamazin, leaning on Prala's shoulder, slowly limped from the room with Polgara, Tenedra, and Velvet close behind her.
"That girl makes me very nervous for some reason,"
Urgot muttered to Tsadi.
"My mother dotes on her, but she has something else on her mind. She never takes her eyes off me."
He shook his head as if to dismiss an unwelcome thought.
"You and your people have had a very busy day, Tsadi. We can talk further tomorrow, after we've both had a good night's sleep."
He reached out and tugged at a silken bell pull, and there was the heavy note of a large gong somewhere outside the throne room. Urgot rolled his eyes toward the ceiling.
"Why does it always have to be those great big bongs and clangs? Someday I'd like to tug on a bell pull and hear a tiny little tinkling bell."
The door at the far end of the throne room opened, and a heavy-shouldered Murgo of late middle age entered. His hair was gray, and his scarred face was heavily lined. There was no hint that a smile had ever touched that grim face.
"Your Majesty, Rang," he said in his rasping voice.
"Yes, Oskatat,"
Urgot replied in an oddly respectful tone.
"Do you suppose that you could escort my good friend Tsadi and his servants to suitable quarters?"
He turned back to Tsadi.
"Oskatat is Lord High Seneschal here. He served my father in the same capacity at Rakoska."
There was no hint of the usual mockery as he spoke.
"My mother and I were not popular in my father's house, and Oskatat was the closest thing to a friend either of us had there."
"My lord," Tsadi said to the big gray-haired man with a deep bow. The seneschal returned a bleak gaze to the king.
"Has my Lady Tamazin retired for the night?"
"Yes, Oskatat."
"Then you should also seek your bed. The hour is late."
"I was just on my way,"
Urgot answered, getting quickly to his feet. Then he stopped.
"Oskatat," he said plaintively, "I'm not a sickly little boy anymore. I don't really need to spend 12 hours in bed every night the way I used to."
"The burdens of the crown are many. You need your rest."
He turned back to Tsadi.
"Follow me," he said, starting toward the door.
"Until tomorrow then, Tsadi," Urgot said. "Sleep well."
"My thanks, your majesty."
The rooms to which the bleak-faced Oskatat took them were as garish as the rest of the Drojum Palace. The walls were painted an unwholesome mustard yellow and hung with splotchy tapestries. The furnishings were carved from rare priceless woods, and the blue Malorian carpet was as deep as the wool on the back of a sheep. Once he had opened the door for them, Oskatat jerked his head in the briefest of nods, then turned and left them alone.
"Charming fellow there," Tsadi murmured.
Geryon had been looking curiously at Silk, who still had his face covered by his hood. Why are you trying so hard to hide? The little man pulled back his hood with a rueful expression.
One of the disadvantages of being a world traveler is that one keeps running into old friends.
I'm not sure I follow you.
Do you remember that time when we were on our way to Rakdol and Tar Urgus caught me and stuck me in that pit?
Yes.
And do you remember why he did that? Why he planned to peel off my skin inch by inch the next day?
You said that you had been in Rakgoska once and accidentally killed his eldest son.
Right. You have an excellent memory, Geryon. Well, as it happened, I had been engaged in some negotiations with Tar Ugras himself before that unfortunate incident. I visited the palace in Rakgoska frequently and met the Lady Tamazun several times. She's almost certain to remember me, particularly in view of the fact that she said that she knew my father.
Yes, that could cause some problems, Belgrath said.
Not if I avoid her, Silk shrugged. Murgo women seldom socialize with men, particularly with strangers. So I don't imagine we'll be bumping into each other very often in the next few days. Oskatat could be a different matter, though. I also met him while I was there.
I think that if it's at all possible, you ought to stay here in our rooms, the old man suggested. It might even keep you out of trouble for a change.
Why, Belgrath, Silk said mildly. What a thing to say.
Has King Agat always been like this? Durnek asked Sadi. He seems awfully, well, humorous. I guess that's the word for it. I didn't think that Murgos even knew how to smile.
Oh, he's a very complex fellow, Sadi replied.
Have you known him long?
He frequently visited Stithis Tor when he was younger, usually on missions for his father. I think he jumped at any excuse to get out of Rakgoska. He and Sal Misra got on rather well together. Of course, that was before Lady Polgra changed her into a snake.
Eunuch rubbed his hand absently over his scalp.
He's not a very strong king, he noted. His childhood in the palace of Tower Urgos made him timid, and he backs away from any sort of confrontation. He is a survivor, though. He's spent his entire life just trying to stay alive, and that tends to make a man very alert.
You'll be talking with him again tomorrow, then, Belgrath said. See if you can get him to give you some definite information about this ship they plan to give us. I want to get to the Isle of Rakat before the onset of winter, and various people in our party have been doing things that might attract attention if we have to stay here too long.
He gave Eriond a reproving look.
It wasn't really my fault, Belgrath, the young man protested mildly. I didn't like the fires in the sanctum, that's all.
Try to keep a grip on your prejudices, Eriond, the old man said in a faintly sarcastic voice. Let's not get sidetracked on these moral crusades just now.
I'll try, Belgrath.
I'd appreciate that.
The next morning, the Seneschal Oskatat summoned them all to another audience with the Murgo King in a brightly candlelit chamber that was smaller and less garish than the vast throne room had been. Geryon noticed that Silk remained carefully hooded until the gray-haired functionary had left the room. Urgot and Tzadi spoke quietly together, while the rest of them sat unobtrusively in the chairs lining the wall.
It was probably the first hint that anyone really had that my father's brains were starting to come off of their hinges, the Murgle King was saying.
He was dressed again in his purple doublet and hose, and was sprawled in a chair with his feet thrust out in front of him.
He was suddenly seized with that wild ambition to make himself over-king of the Angorak. Personally, I think that Klutschik planted the notion in his head as a means of irritating Urvan,
Anyway, he continued, twisting the heavy gold ring on one of his fingers, it took the combined efforts of all of his generals to convince my manic father that Zakath's army was about 5 times the size of ours, and that Zakath could squash him like a bug any time he chose. Once that notion had finally seeped into his head, he went absolutely wild.
Oh? Zadi said.
Urgot grinned, threw himself on the floor, and started chewing on the carpet. After he calmed down, he decided to try subversion instead. He inundated Meloria with Murgo agents, and Murgos are probably the clumsiest spies in the world. Now, to keep it short, Zakath was about 19 at the time, and desperately in love with a Melusine girl. Her family was deeply in debt, so my father's agents bought up all of their obligations and started putting pressure on them. The brilliant plan that emerged from my father's diseased wits was that the girl should encourage the love-struck young Zakath, marry him, and then slip a knife between the imperial ribs at her earliest opportunity. One of the Melusines these highly intelligent Murgle spies had bought to help them in their schemes ran to Zakath with the whole sordid story, and the girl and her entire family were immediately put to death.
What a tragic story, Zadi murmured.
Huh, you haven't heard the best part yet. Several of the Murgle spies were persuaded to reveal the whole story. Melorians tend to be very good persuaders. And Zakath discovered to his horror that the girl had known absolutely nothing about my father's plan. He locked himself in his room in the palace at Malzeth for an entire month. When he went in, he was a pleasant, open young man who showed much promise of becoming one of Meloria's greatest emperors. When he came out, he was the cold-blooded monster we all know and love. He rounded up every Murgo in Meloria, including a fair number of my father's relatives, and he used to amuse himself by sending bits and pieces of them in ornate containers to Rakoska, accompanied by highly insulting notes.
But didn't the two of them join forces at the Battle of Tul Mardu?
Urgot laughed. Ha! That may be the popular perception, Zadi. But in point of fact, the Imperial Princess Zenedra's army was just unlucky enough to get between two opposing Angrak monarchs. They didn't care a thing about her or about that dung heap that people call Mishrak Akthul. All they were trying to do was kill each other. Then my addled father made the mistake of challenging King Kohag of Algaria to single combat, and Kohag gave him a very pointed lesson in swordsmanship.
He looked thoughtfully into the fire.
I still think I ought to send Kohag some token of appreciation, he mused.
Excuse me, Your Majesty, Toddy frowned. But I don't altogether understand. Kal Zakath's quarrel was with your father, and Taurogas is dead.
Oh, yes, quite dead. I cut his throat before I buried him, just to make sure. I think that Zakath's problem stems from the fact that he didn't get the chance to kill my father personally. Failing that, I guess he's willing to settle for me.
He rose and began to pace moodily up and down.
I have sent him a dozen peace overtures. But all he does is send me back the heads of my emissaries. I think he is as crazy as my father was.
He stopped his restless pacing.
You know, maybe I was a bit hasty on my way to the throne. I had a dozen brothers, all of the blood of Taurogas. If I'd kept a few of them alive, I might have been able to give them to Zakath. Perhaps if he had drunk enough Urga blood, it might have made him lose his taste for it.
The door opened, and a bulky Murgo with an ornate gold chain about his neck entered the room.
I need your signature on this,
he said rudely to Urgot, thrusting a sheet of parchment at him.
What is it, General Craddock?
Urgot asked meekly. The officer's face darkened.
All right,
Urgot said in a mollifying tone.
Don't get yourself excited.
He took the parchment to a nearby table, where a quill pen lay beside a silver inkpot. He dipped the pen, scribbled his name on the bottom of the sheet, and handed it back.
Thank you, Your Majesty, General Craddock said, then turned on his heel and left the room.
One of my father's generals, Urgot told Sadi sourly. They all treat me like that.
He began to pace up and down again, scuffing his feet at the carpet.
How much do you know about King Bulgarian, Sadi?
He asked suddenly. The eunuch shrugged.
Well, I have met him once or twice.
Didn't you say that most of your servants are Aelorn's?
Aelorn mercenaries, yes. They are dependable and very good to have around if a fight breaks out.
The Murgo King turned to Belgoroth, who sat dozing in a chair.
You, old man, he said abruptly. Have you ever met Belgarion of Riva?
Several times, Belgoroth admitted calmly.
What kind of man is he?
Sincere, Belgoroth replied. He tries very hard to be a good king.
Just how powerful is he?
Well, he has the whole Aelorn Alliance to back him up. Technically, he is the overlord of the West. Although the Tol Nedrons are likely to go their own way, and the Erends would rather fight each other.
That's not what I meant. How good of a sorcerer is he?
Why ask me, Your Majesty? Do I look like the kind of man who would know very much about that sort of thing? He managed to kill Torak, though, and I would imagine that took a bit of doing.
How about Belgoroth? Is there really such a person, or is he just a myth?
No, Belgoroth is a real person.
And he's 7,000 years old?
7,000 or so, Belgoroth shrugged, give or take a few centuries.
And his daughter Bulgara?
She is also a real person.
And she is thousands of years old?
Something like that. I could probably figure it out if I needed to, but a gentleman does not ask questions about a lady's age. Urgot laughed, a short, ugly, barking sound.
No words, gentlemen, and Murgo are mutually exclusive, my friend. Do you think Belgarion would receive my emissaries if I sent them to Riva?
He is out of the country just now, Belgoroth told him blandly.
I had not heard that.
He does it from time to time. Every so often he gets bored with all of the ceremony and goes away.
How does he manage that? How can he just pick up and leave?
Who's going to argue with him? Urgot began to gnaw worriedly on one fingernail.
Even if the Dagashi Kabak succeeds in killing Zakath, I am still going to have a Malorian army on my doorstep. I'm going to need an ally if I'm ever going to get rid of them.
He began to pace up and down again.
Besides, if I can reach an agreement with Belgarion, maybe I'll be able to get Agachak's fist off my throat. Do you think he would listen to a proposal from me?
You could ask him and find out, I suppose. The door opened again, and the Queen Mother, assisted by the girl Prala, entered.
Ah, good morning, Mother,
Urgot greeted her.
Why are you out roaming the halls of this madhouse?
Urgot, she said firmly, you'd be much more admirable if you stopped trying to make a joke out of everything.
It keeps me from brooding about my circumstances, he told her. I'm losing a war. Half of my subjects want to depose me and send my head to Zakath on a plate. I'll be going mad soon. And I think I'm developing a boil on my neck. There are only a few things left for me to laugh about, Mother, so please, let me enjoy a joke or two while I still can.
Why do you keep insisting that you are going to go mad? Every male in the Urga family for the past 500 years has gone mad before he reached 50,
he reminded her.
It is one of the reasons we make such good kings. Nobody in his right mind would want the throne of Tol Murgos. Was there anything special you wanted, Mother? Or did you just want to enjoy my fascinating companionship?
She looked around the room.
Which of you, gentlemen, is married to that little red-haired girl?
Geryon looked up quickly.
Is she all right, my lady? Paul, the lady with the white lock at her brow said that you should come at once. The young woman seems to be in some distress.
Geryon stood up to follow as the Queen Mother started slowly back toward the door. Just before she reached it, she stopped and glanced at Silk, who had pulled up his hood as soon as she had entered.
"Why don't you accompany your friend?" she suggested. "Just for the sake of appearances."
They went out of the room, and on down one of the garish halls of the Drojum, to a dark paneled door guarded by a pair of mail-shirted men-at-arms. One of them opened the door with a respectful bow to Lady Tamazin, and she led them inside. Her quarters were decorated much more tastefully than the rest of the Drojum. The walls were white, and the decor much more subdued. Aunt Paul sat on a low divan holding the weeping Synedra in her arms with Velvet standing nearby.
"Is she all right?"
Geryon's fingers asked quickly.
"I don't think it's too serious,"
Polgaro's hands replied.
"A bout of nerves, most likely. But I don't want any of these fits of depression to go on for too long. She still hasn't fully recovered from her melancholia. See if you can comfort her."
Geryon went to the divan and enclosed Synedra gently in his arms. She clung to him, still weeping.
"Is this young lady subject to these crying spells, Paul?"
Queen Mother asked, as the two of them took chairs on opposite sides of the cheery fire that danced on the grate.
"Not all that frequently, Tamazin," Polgara answered. "There's been a recent tragedy in her family, though, and sometimes her nerves get the best of her." "Ah," Urgot's mother said. "Could I offer you a cup of tea, Paul? I always find tea in the morning so comforting." "Why, thank you, Tamazin. I think that would be very nice."
Gradually, Tenedra's weeping subsided, though she still clung tightly to Geryon. At last, she raised her head and wiped at her eyes with her fingertips.
"I'm so very sorry,"
she apologized.
"I don't know what came over me."
"It's all right, dear,"
Geryon murmured, his arms still about her shoulders. She dabbed at her eyes again, using a wispy little handkerchief.
"I must look absolutely terrible,"
she said with a teary little laugh. "Moderately terrible, yes," he agreed, smiling.
"I told you once, dear, that you should never cry in public. You just don't have the right coloring for it,"
Polgara said. Synedra smiled tremulously and stood up.
"Perhaps I should go wash my face. And then I think I'd like to lie down for a bit."
She turned to Geryon.
"Thank you for coming,"
she said simply.
"Any time you need me." "Why don't you go with Lady Prala?"
Lady Tamazin suggested.
"Of course,"
the slender Murgle princess agreed, coming quickly to her feet. Silk had been standing nervously near the door with the hood of his green robe pulled up and his head down to keep his face concealed.
"Oh, do stop that, Prince Keldar,"
the Queen Mother told him, after Synedra and Prala had left the room.
"I recognized you last night, so it is no good your trying to hide your face."
He sighed then and pushed his hood back. "I was afraid you might have."
"That hood does not hide your most salient feature anyway."
"And which feature was that, my lady?"
"Your nose, Keldar. That long, sharp-pointed nose that precedes you wherever you go."
"But it's such a noble nose, my lady,"
Velvet said with a dimpled smile.
"He wouldn't be nearly the man he is without it."
"Do you mind?" Silk asked her.
"You do get around, don't you, Prince Keldar?"
Lady Tamazin said to him.
"How long has it been since you left Rakoska, with half of the Murgo army hot on your heels?"
"15, maybe 20 years, my lady," he replied, coming closer to the fire.
"I was sorry to hear that you had left. You are not a very prepossessing-looking fellow, but your conversation was most entertaining, and there was very little in the way of entertainment in the House of Taurogas."
"You don't plan to make a general announcement about my identity, then, I take it?"
"It is not my concern, Keldar. Murgo women do not involve themselves in the affairs of men. Over the centuries, we have found that it is safer that way."
"You're not upset then, my lady?" Geryon asked her. "What I mean is, I had heard that Prince Keldar here accidentally killed the eldest son of Taurogas. Didn't that offend you just a little?"
"It had nothing to do with me.
The one Keldar killed was the child of Tawr Urgus's first wife, an insufferable, toothless hag of the House of Gorut, who used to gloat over the fact that she had given birth to the heir apparent, and that as soon as he ascended the throne, she was going to have the rest of us strangled.
I am relieved to hear that you had no particular fondness for the young man, Silk told her.
Fondness? He was a monster, just like his father. When he was a little boy, he used to amuse himself by dropping live puppies into boiling water. The world is a better place without him.
Silk assumed a lofty expression. I always like to perform these little public services.
I feel that it's a gentleman's civic duty.
I thought you said that his death was accidental.
Well, sort of. Actually, I was trying to stab him in the belly. Painful, perhaps, but seldom fatal. But he bumped my arm as I made the thrust, and somehow my knife went straight into his heart. What a shame,
Temujin murmured.
I'd be sort of careful here in the Drojum, though, Keldar. I have no intention of revealing your identity. But the Seneschal, Oskatat, also knows you by sight, and he would probably feel obliged to denounce you.
I thought I'd guessed as much, my lady. I'll try to avoid him.
Now tell me, Prince Keldar, how is your father?
Silk sighed. He died, I'm afraid, he replied sadly. Quite a few years ago. It was rather sudden. As chance had it, Geryon was looking directly at the Queen Mother's face as Silk spoke, and he saw the momentary flicker of anguish touching her beautiful features. She recovered quickly, though, and her eyes still brimmed with sorrow.
Oh,
she said very quietly.
I'm sorry, Keldar. More sorry than you could possibly know. I liked your father very much. The memories of the months he was in Rakoska are among the happiest of my life.
To avoid being caught staring, Geryon turned his head and his eyes fell on Velvet, whose expression was faintly speculative. She returned his look, and her eyes conveyed a world of meaning and several unanswered questions. Chapter 14. The following morning dawned clear and cold. Geryon stood at the window of his room looking out over the slate rooftops of Rak-Urga. The low, squat houses seemed to huddle together fearfully under the twin presence of the garish Drojum Palace at one end of town and the black temple of Torak at the other. The smoke from hundreds of chimneys rose in straight blue columns toward the windless sky. Depressing sort of a place, isn't it? Silk said, as he came into the room with his green robe carelessly slung over one shoulder. Geryon nodded.
It looks almost as if they deliberately went out of their way to make it ugly.
It is a reflection of the Murko mind. Oh, Urgot wants to see us again. The little man caught Geryon's inquiring look. I don't think it's anything particularly important. He's probably just starved for conversation. I imagine that talking with Murkos can get tedious after a while. They all trooped through the garish halls on the heels of the mail-shirted guard who had brought the king's summons, returning to the room where they had met with Urgot the previous day. They found him lounging in a chair by the fire with one leg cocked up over the arm and a half-eaten chicken leg in his hand.
"Good morning, gentlemen," he greeted them. "Please, sit down."
He waved his breakfast at the chairs lined up against one wall.
"I'm not much of a one for formality."
He looked at Sadi.
"Did you sleep well?"
"I got a bit cold toward morning, Your Majesty."
"It's the slipshod construction of this place. There are cracks in the walls big enough to push a horse through. In the wintertime we have snowstorms in the corridors."
He sighed then.
"Do you realize that it is spring in Tol Hanath right now?"
He sighed again, then glanced at Bulgarath, who stood smiling peculiarly at him.
"Was there something amusing, old boy?"
"Not really. Just remembering something I heard once."
The old man went to the fire and held out his hands to the crackling flames.
How are your people coming on that ship?
I expect that it's going to be tomorrow at the earliest before it is ready. Winter is coming on, and the seas around the south tip of the Urga Peninsula are never what you would call placid, even in the best of seasons. So I ordered the shipwrights to take special pains.
He leaned forward and negligently tossed his chicken leg into the fireplace.
It was burned, he said absently. Every meal I get in this place is either burned or raw.
He looked peculiarly at Belgarath.
You intrigue me, old man. You don't seem like the type to wind up his career hiring himself out to a nice enslaver.
Appearances can be deceiving, Belgarath shrugged.
You don't look much like a king, either, but you do have the crown, after all.
Birgit reached up and pulled off his iron circlet. He looked at it distastefully, then held it out to Belgarath.
You want this thing? I am sure you'd look more regal than I do, and I would be very happy to get rid of it, particularly in view of the fact that Kalzakath so keenly wants to take my head out from under it.
He dropped it on the floor beside his chair with a dull clunk.
Let's go back to something we were discussing yesterday. You told me that you know Belgarian.
Belgarath nodded.
How well?
How well can any man know another?
You are evading my question.
It seems that way, doesn't it? Birgit let that pass. He looked intently at the old man.
How do you think Belgarian would really react if I proposed that he ally himself with me to drive the Malorians off of this continent? I'm sure their presence here worries him almost as much as it does me.
The chances aren't very good, Belgarath told him. You might be able to persuade Belgarian that it's a good idea, but the rest of the Elorn monarchs would probably object.
They reached an accommodation with Drosta, didn't they?
That was between Rodar and Drosta. There has always been a certain wary friendship between the Drasnians and the Nadrax. The one you would need to get to accept your idea would be Kohag, and Kohag's never been exactly cordial to Murgos.
I need allies, old man, not platitudes. What if I got word to Belgarath?
What would you say to him?
I would try to persuade him that Zakath's a much greater danger to the kingdoms of the West than I am. Maybe he could make the Elorns listen to reason.
I don't think you would have much luck there, either. The old man looked into the dancing flames with the firelight gleaming on his short, silvery beard. You have to understand that Belgarath does not live in the same world with ordinary men. He lives in the world of first causes, primal forces.